Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Drugs, Addiction, and Recovery, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Emily Dufton, and today we'll be talking to Dennis McDougall, author of the new book, Operation White Rabbit, LSD, the DEA, and the Fate of the Acid King. McDougall is a veteran American author and journalist, as well as a native Californian who's been called LA's number one muckraker. The author of 11 works of nonfiction and two novels, Operation White Rabbit is his newest book. Dennis, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me, Emily.
So you're really prolific. This is your 14th book. 14 is amazing. But your previous works were quite different from Operation White Rabbit. They were things like a biography of Bob Dylan, The Business of Hollywood, even an examination of Jack Nicholson's career. Now, there are certainly ties between Hollywood and the drug industry, both legal and illegal, but it doesn't seem like what you were writing about concerned drugs too much before. So how did you develop your career and what brought you to write about LSD?
Well, I'll answer the first question first and the second one second, which seems like a logical way to go about it. I'm a veteran journalist. I got my start in newspapering, which for your younger listeners, it was a quaint way of communicating in the last century. People actually printed things on paper and delivered them to your driveway each morning. That doesn't happen much anymore, but back in my day, I was a newspaper reporter, and then I did some broadcast with CNN. Most of my career, I spent at the Los Angeles Times, although I did a stint at the New York Times about, 15, 20 years ago. And that got me into looking at publishing books. I found that a newspaper and even a magazine kind of limited you. So books gave you an opportunity to really dive in and dig into a subject way down deep. So that's how I got into writing books. It's been doing it for 20 years now and enjoying the heck out of it. in answer to your second question, how did I get involved in writing about drugs? Well, I got a call one day from another writer that I did a couple of magazine articles with, and she told me that the guy who invented LSD, Dr. Albert Hoffman, was turning 100 years old and was celebrating his birthday in Basel, Switzerland, and that it would be a great opportunity to meet everybody who had ever had anything to do with LSD and try to capture some interviews with them, maybe turn it into at least a lengthy magazine article and possibly a book. So I went to his birthday party, and sure enough, everybody who had had anything to do with psychedelics showed up.
Wow. What year was this?
It's 2006, wow. January of 2006. And actually, Hoffman lived to be, I think, 103. I think he died 2 or 3 years later. At any rate, we did do the magazine piece for Playboy magazine. But we, at the same time, saw this grand opportunity to maybe turn it into a documentary film, because the real history of LSD and psychedelics had never really been put on film before. So we hired a film crew in Switzerland and did 2 days worth of interviews with everyone and anyone who had anything to do with psychedelics. And it was during this time that I heard about this guy who was doing 2 life sentences in a federal prison in the United States for the crime of having manufactured LSD. And that struck me as being a little draconian. I mean, there are murderers and rapists who get less time than the fellow that I heard about. His name was William Leonard Picard.
And somewhat ironic, given that you're in Switzerland at a birthday party for the man who created LSD, celebrating the creation of this drug, and yet there's someone else in the United States serving 2 consecutive life sentences for its manufacturing. I'd imagine the cognitive dissonance of that experience was somewhat pronounced.
Just a tad. Actually, it was 2 life sentences plus 20 years.
Oh, just in case he got through them. Yeah. The additional punitive measure is important there. Yeah.
Picard used to joke with me that the 20 years was added on because he was a Buddhist, and they thought that perhaps he would have a secondary life beyond the life sentences. So they wanted to make absolutely sure that he never got out.
If he gets off the wheel of samsara as a human again, 20 years are coming for him. That is punitive. But that's fascinating. So tell us a bit about this person. The man at the center of Operation White Rabbit, you know, the title of the book says it all. Who is this acid king?
Well, Leonard Picard was a prodigy. He was a science prodigy from the 1960s, graduated at the top of his class and won all kinds of national awards, wound up going to Princeton. But he dropped out of Princeton within a year of showing up at the gates because he was busted for stealing a car and crossing state lines, none of which made any sense at the time. But his father, who was an attorney, struck a deal with the court to have him put away in a rehab in Connecticut in lieu of going to jail. And Leonard had to drop out of Princeton and did his time in psychiatric care. When he got out, he decided to move to the West Coast because this was the late 1960s, and he'd heard a lot about LSD and about a new way of life in the Bay Area of California. He moved there, and for the next 20 years, he went to school, but never officially. And he became an underground chemist. He learned the craft of organic chemistry and began apprenticing himself to people like Stanley Owsley and the Brotherhood of Eternal Love, all of whom were involved in the manufacture and distribution of psychedelics in the 60s and 70s. And he disappeared into the acid underground. It's the bulk of Operation White Rabbit is about who he was, how he grew up in Atlanta with, you know, very accomplished parents, and then how he fell into the acid underground and became a rogue manufacturer of LSD and other psychedelics, and how he eventually became a criminal in essence.
Right. Before we get into the details of his evolution, I guess you could say, I did think that that was one of the most fascinating elements of this book, was how, you know, beyond the absolutely wild story of Leonard himself, there's also, you know, this history of LSD production and use in America from basically the mid 20th century onward. And you have cameos from everybody who influenced psychedelic American drug culture. So as you said, you know, there's Owsley Stanley, the Brotherhood of Eternal Love. There's Ram Dass, Timothy Leary, Sasha Shulgin, Mark Kleiman, everybody who's anybody concerned with this element of American drug history is in this book, which I thought was just so fun to kind of see them in a different way, sort of through the lens of Leonard. So how does Leonard play into the larger history of LSD in America?
Well, he knew all of these people in one way or another, some of them very intimately. He was essentially, you mentioned Alexander Shulgin, also known to his friends as Sasha, probably the premier underground psychedelic chemist of the 20th century. And, you know, Leonard made a point of tracking him down and apprenticing himself to Sasha in the, I guess it would have been the early 80s or the late 70s. And they became very, very close. The fact that he knew all of these people in one way or another, and maintained that kind of communication even after he was busted two or three times, and he did a prison stint before the big bust in 2000. So he spent an awful lot of time behind bars, but he knew all of these people, and from my vantage point, it looked like a golden opportunity to essentially tell the untold story of psychedelic chemistry from Albert Hoffman on through the life and times of this incredibly colorful and intelligent man who was wrongly put behind bars for the crime of being a chemist.
Mm. It's such a rich story. It's so it's such a great perspective. But before Leonard is a criminal, he's a businessman, really. So how did Leonard get involved in the acid industry?
Well, I mean, like any other good capitalist, he saw a need and filled it. I mean, the law of supply and demand was at least as important to him as any law of chemistry. And the man, he saw that the demand was there, that it always had been, but it became more intense after 1970 when the Nixon administration established the Drug Enforcement Administration or agency, and outlawed LSD and a host of other psychedelics, made them Schedule I drugs. and thus made it illegal to possess them, as well as certainly not to manufacture or distribute them. He learned that that not only is it profitable to manufacture the stuff, but it can be equally profitable to sell it. And he over time established a network of fellow travelers. I hesitate to call them distributors, because the underground was such that most of these people saw psychedelics and their use as being tantamount to a sacrament. They weren't selling a product; they were enlightening the world. I mean, that part of Timothy O'Leary's evangelism was true then, as it remains so to today, at least in the mind of psychonauts.
I love that term, psychonauts. Can you describe it? And could you also tell us a little bit more about these associates of Leonard's? Because, you know, as I was reading Operation White Rabbit, I saw him having allies and antagonists throughout his experience.
Well, I tried to be as true to the tale as told by Picard as possible, while at the same time retaining my natural journalistic objectivity, or at least an attempt at that. Leonard saw himself, as I said, as an evangelist, and as I think, as I said before, he was busted once before. I mean, he was not a first time offender, which in part accounted for the terrible sentence that he wound up getting in 2000. But he was busted for LSD manufacture in the late 1980s, and he wound up going to a federal prison in Los Angeles for about 4 years. When he got out in 1992, he swore that he had seen the light and he was changing his ways, and immediately went to a Zen Buddhist center in San Francisco, and studied to become a Buddhist monk, which essentially is what he ultimately did. But, you know, he spent a year or so at the Zen center, and at the same time, he was studying chemistry on the side at Berkeley. And he had, you had mentioned Mark Kleiman, and he met him while he was doing his prison time in L.A. And it was Kleiman who suggested that he consider going to the Kennedy School at Harvard, and perhaps bringing his expertise in terms of drugs and drug manufacture to an international diplomatic, I don't know, career. So Leonard applied, and with Kleiman's help, got into the Kennedy School, and spent the middle part of the 1990s, about 1994 through 98, studying at Harvard. And he earned a master's degree in diplomacy, and he began, jetting around the world to every place you can think of that had any kind of a drug problem.
And is this where he starts to develop some theories that have proven quite prescient as far as the opioid crisis right now? Is this where he starts doing his work on fentanyl?
Absolutely. One of the first places that he visited was Russia, and they were already developing fentanyl there. And he tracked down a fellow in Wichita, Kansas, of all places, who was doing a 20-year stint for manufacturing fentanyl and selling it in the United States. It was shown in court that this particular fellow, his name escapes me at the moment, but at any rate, he his fentanyl was responsible for at least a dozen deaths of people overdosing on it. And Leonard saw this as, you know, a warning sign because, he wrote a paper and delivered it to the faculty club at Harvard in 1996, I believe. But it was about the coming opioid crisis that would be international in scope, according to him. And he blamed, you know, the development of fentanyl as being at the base of this this problem that was going to be cropping up.
And 25 fentanyl. Years later, he's proven entirely correct.
And it helped him. You know, I might just add here very quickly that it was that prescience that in part resulted in his release last summer from prison, because he appealed through his attorney to Congress itself. Each and every member of Congress got a letter and a study from him, and the RAND Corporation, in its latest paper on the opioid crisis, cited Leonard's groundbreaking studies as being at the heart of the current crackdown.
Wow. Well, so here he is in the late 90s. He's doing some incredible work at the Harvard school at Harvard. He's exploring the potentials of fentanyl and what that might how that might affect American drug policy. He's a Zen Buddhist monk. And then a couple of years later, he's in jail for two consecutive life sentences. What happens?
Well, I would not want to mislead, readers and or your listeners to make Leonard look like he's strictly an academic or a theologian. He was many different people. I mean, obviously, his very first felony back when he was still in his teens was Grand Theft Auto. So Leonard, walked a thin line his entire life between academia, a scholastic, ascetic life, and a walk on the wild side. he knew loads and loads of professors. But at the same time, he was friendly with and literally trafficking with people who had extensive criminal records. What happened? I mean, the big what led to his downfall, his ultimate downfall, was meeting a fellow named Skinner, Gordon Skinner, who was himself an amateur chemist and who took an early interest way back when he was in high school in Oklahoma in psychedelics and, lots of psychedelics way beyond LSD. He he perfected a recipe for DMT, which is a strong form of hallucinogen, and ayahuasca. I'm sure that most people know what that is by now. Skinner was, but Skinner was also, you know, he made Picard look like a piker when it came to translating his chemical knowledge into felonies. He got busted for carrying gunny sacks of peyote across the Mexican border. And
what could go wrong?
Yeah, well, he had a freighter full of marijuana that he had to land in Jamaica at one point. And he was busted numerous times. He, as a direct result of all of these busts, made deals to stay out of jail and out of prison with the Drug Enforcement Administration and state narcotics agencies where he got busted.
Right. And is this where the DEA essentially gets involved? You know, the DEA is obviously a core part of this story. It's part of the subtitle. So can you tell us a little bit about the DEA's involvement with Leonard's downfall? What was Operation White Rabbit?
Well, the DEA was closing in on Skinner. I mean, for the umpteenth time, by the late 1990s, he had managed to make enough money legally and especially illegally to purchase his very own retired Atlas silo, Atlas missile silo.
And can you describe briefly what that is? Because when I think of silos, I think of, you know, the large, you know, semi-rounded sort of tubular things on a farm that hold like corn. And I had to watch a couple YouTube videos, but I realized that's not, this isn't holding corn and it's not above ground. Because can you tell us more about what an Atlas missile silo is?
I think you're cutting out a little bit here, Emily, but but I got the gist of what you were asking.
Okay.
That's okay. During the height of the Cold War in the 1950s and early 60s, the paranoia in Washington, D.C. was such that they decided the best way to counter any kind of a atomic attack on the United States would be to have defensive missiles ready to go. And Congress approved these Atlas missiles, and they were located at throughout the Midwest and the Plain States, in what were then secret locations. You have to dig down pretty deep to hide an Atlas missile, so. They created these silos that were, several stories deep under the ground. And eastern Kansas was one of the favorite places for these missiles. And the one in particular that we're talking about here that Skinner purchased, because, you know, after the Cold War came to an end, they decided, the government decided they didn't need these any longer, so they sold them. And Skinner saw that this one was up for sale. It was located right outside of Wamego, which is characterizes itself as the home of the Wizard of Oz, has an an Oz museum, and everything's named after L. Frank Baum and the Wizard and Dorothy and what have you in Wamego. So Skinner had this Atlas missile silo, and he converted it to a laboratory and a test site for the various and sundry psychedelic compounds that he was coming up with. And he would stage parties and mini conventions and invite people in the acid underground to come to his silo and try out his latest concoctions.
It's a silo party, you know? No, why not?
There you go. Makes sense, doesn't it?
If so I had a silo,
you don't have one? Emily, where you're slipping. You need a silo.
I got to get a silo if I'm going to be a real drug historian. It's a requirement.
I think so. Absolutely.
What happened at this silo? Yeah.
Well, Skinner and Picard met at Picard maintains that it was at a conference of ethnobotany in San Francisco. Skinner, on the other hand, maintains that they met earlier through a third chemist who operated and continues to operate to this day out of Taos, New Mexico. Exactly how and when they met is up in the air, but they did in fact meet, and they saw that they shared interests, and they began putting together an acid enterprise with Leonard as the mastermind, the master chemist, and Skinner as essentially the chief financial officer. And they began making the stuff, and or at least Leonard would make the stuff, and then Skinner would find ways to sell it and launder the money that they got. And it amounted to, if you believe the Drug Enforcement Administration, it amounted to millions and millions of dollars. If you, on the other hand, believe both Picard and Skinner, one of the few things that they do agree on, it was probably a few hundred thousand, but certainly not the huge amount of money that the DEA later advertised it as being.
Right. Now, their relationship is is a very complicated one. It's really fraught. And as they move toward kind of the end of their story, as we move toward Leonard's downfall, they both seem to be kind of losing control in a lot of ways. Skinner is an incredibly violent person. Some of the descriptions that you wrote of what he did were shocking and horrible. But Leonard's also kind of losing his grips with reality. So I was wondering if you can kind of bring us up to the downfall. I don't want to, ruin the book for anybody. This is such an exciting thing. But to kind of discuss sort of how they were feeling toward the end of their relationship with each other, and what ultimately kind of brought Leonard to this point where he was given two consecutive life sentences plus 20 years.
Well, again, you have to go back to who Leonard was and what he was, what his ultimate objective was. He got a taste of of Harvard and the academic life while he was working on his master's at the Kennedy School. And he decided the best way to succeed in the upper world was by staging a symposium, which would expand upon what he'd already been exploring with fentanyl and the emerging the new drugs, both psychedelic and otherwise, that he saw as being possibly a scourge in the 21st century. So he was very interested in trying to come up with enough money to stage this international symposium at Harvard. And Skinner, who was, in addition to all of his other accomplishments, was an excellent pathological liar, came up with a phony baloney idea about his good friend, the financier Warren Buffett, paying the freight for this symposium, which would amount to $300,000 or $400,000, and he used that to string Leonard along for at least a year, maybe closer to two, and involved him more and more deeply in his own version of the drug trade, operating out of his missile silo. And when it looked like the Drug Enforcement Administration was going to finally close in on Skinner, because, you know, it's kind of hard to keep those parties under wraps. Sooner or later, somebody's gonna squeal on you. Skinner made a deal with a hard-charging young DEA agent out of San Francisco to rat out Picard and essentially frame him as the Acid King. I mean, Leonard never called himself the Acid King, and has always maintained that much of the story was made up in Gordon Skinner's imagination. But he was the target, and the DEA set up a sting operation, and on Election Day of 2000, when George Bush triumphed over Al Gore for the presidency, Picard was being busted in Wamego, Kansas, for being the biggest underground LSD chemist in history.
It's a really extraordinary story, the way you describe the bust. And it's been told a couple of times now that Picard is back in the news after his July 2020 release from prison, which I do want to discuss, but very briefly, there is a photo of you and Leonard in the book taken at the Tucson Federal Prison where Leonard was being held. Can you tell us a little bit about your relationship with him? How did you get to know him, and how did you arrange interviews when he was incarcerated?
Well, you know, going back to Hoffman's birthday party in 2006, you know, I saw this story, the story of this Picard character as being, you know, almost Shakespearean, and certainly worth telling. So I tracked down where he was in the federal prison system and became his pen pal initially. After an exchange of many letters I got on the phone with him, and we got to know each other that way. And as time went on, I discovered that Leonard had literary ambitions of his own. He wanted to tell the story of the bust from his point of view. So I encouraged him to enroll in a prison writing workshop, which he did, and he got a taste of publishing some of his essays and in a prison journal in Arizona, where he was doing his time in Tucson Federal Correctional Institute. And he decided he was going to, write his own book. So I encouraged him with that. He began floating stuff past me to look at. And at the same time, I was writing a book at the time about Bob Dylan. And I sent pages to him, and he, we exchanged our work. We got to be increasingly friendly. I met his writing coach, and then I applied to visit him, and was accepted. So I went down to Tucson and met him in the flesh a couple of times. And then that evolved into a stronger relationship when he finally was allowed email. And I started to visit him more often. I would stop in Tucson a couple of times a year. And then he finally published his book, which is available out there on Amazon, called The Rose of Paracelsus, quite a tome, 650 pages or thereabouts. He developed this cult following over and above his legendary career as a chemist.
Right. And now, so he was planning on spending the rest of his natural life in prison, given two consecutive life sentences in 20 years. But then less than a year ago, on July 24th, 2020, he was suddenly released from prison. It really changes the end of your book. You sort of tag on, you discuss what you thought the end was going to be and then what the end actually ended up being. Why was he released from prison? What happened?
Well, it goes back to this fentanyl thing that we were talking about earlier. He had pretty much exhausted his appeals, been turned down repeatedly by the 10th Circuit. So his final play was a compassionate release, which would be based in part on his age. Leonard just turned 75 and had some health issues. And the changes in attitudes towards drugs in general and psychedelics in particular, since he had been incarcerated, things had, the culture had changed considerably in that 20 years. And through his attorney, he put together a presentation for Congress and the U.S. Senate and the Obama administration, and began his appeal back in 2015, I think, or thereabouts. And they just kept at it and kept sending writs and appeals to through the Bureau of Prisons. And ultimately, one day, out of the blue, a federal appeals judge issued this this release and said, you know, I'm summarizing here because it was several pages long, but essentially the judge said, this guy doesn't deserve this. He's done enough time. Let him out. And Leonard was literally told one day and had to pack up his belongings from he'd collected in prison for the past 20 years and leave the next day. He didn't even, you know, have a, I mean, fortunately, the mother of his son lived in New Mexico, not too many miles away. And he was able to quickly contact her, but even she wasn't able to get down to pick him up in time. He had to get on a midnight bus out of Tucson and go to Albuquerque, where she picked him up the following day.
I can't imagine what that must have been like.
A pleasant surprise.
To be released from prison overnight.
And everyone that he got out.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. It's absolutely extraordinary.
He's working as a paralegal, of all things, for a law firm in Santa Fe.
Wow. So he's working as a paralegal. How is he doing? And what did he think of your book?
You're breaking up again, Emily.
Oh, sorry. So how is he doing? And can you hear me now?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay. I'll make a note of that 46 minutes. Edit that out. So how is he doing now? You said he's 75. He's working as a paralegal, but he is free. How is he doing? And what did he think of your book?
Well, I let him see it before I published it. But I made the same deal that I made with a couple of other subjects who granted me access on previous books. I said, I will let you read it, but, you know, you don't have last say on what's published. You can make suggestions. And if you find something that's inaccurate, I certainly want to correct it. But insofar as the tone and who I talk to and what I quote you as saying, that's completely up to me. He accepted those terms and he did read it. He did object to several things. If his objections reached into something other than accuracy, I told him, you know, that's just the way it is. I have to be true to my readers first, not to the subject that I'm writing about. And, you know, I mean, to his credit, Leonard got that and continues to get that. He ultimately, you know, he would have changed some things, I'm sure. But he liked it. He accepted the book and said that it was, true portrayal of who he was and where he came from and where he has ended up.
Which is the highest praise you can get when you're writing about a living subject. So that's great.
Yeah. And insofar as how he's doing, well, you know, as I said, he got a job right away and he reunited with his children, all of which was very good. I understand recently that he's had some health problems, but he's dealing with them and he's adjusting well, I think.
Wow.
He did tell me a little story about after he got out, after he left, prison, you know, he had to get to the bus station. I'm not even sure that they drove him into the bus station, but somehow he got there in time to catch the bus. Then, and he wanted to warn his girlfriend that he was on his way, and he was looking around for a payphone. He didn't find one. Somebody saw him and offered his cell phone to him, and he had to spend 5 minutes getting a lecture on how to use it because he had no idea.
Of course, of course.
So wow. He's had a kind of a Rip Van Winkle kind of awakening to the brave new world that we all have come to accept. But, you know, I mean, when he was busted and went away, the internet was, barely 5 years old. And none of what we take as take for granted today is even existed. So he's had to make a lot of adjustments.
Right. It's a whole new world. It must be. Okay. Well, we've taken up a lot of your time. Dennis, I just want to thank you for coming on the show today and discussing this new book, which is an absolutely incredible biography of Leonard Picard. It's called Operation White Rabbit, LSD, the DEA, and the Fate of the Acid King. And it was released last year by Skyhorse Publishing. So in closing, I just want to ask you our customary last question, which is, what project are you working on now?
Okay, well, at the moment, I am I'm doing several things. I'm working on a documentary. I'm co-producing with an old friend about Rodney King, who was I befriended 25 years ago, shortly after his famous beating on TV. So that's in the works, doing the documentary of his life story. And I'm working on an extended history of the failed mental health system in the United States since Ronald Reagan dismantled it 40 years ago.
And, that's huge.
Sorry, effects that all of that has had on mental patients throughout the country. And I'm also working on bringing a couple of my previous books to the screen, hopefully the big screen. In one instance, my book has been optioned for a feature film on the Robert Blake Bonnie Bakley murder of 1999, I guess it was. I wrote a book called Blood Cold, and that's being turned into a motion picture. I'm also working on a series based on my book about the history of the Los Angeles Times.
Wow.
So I'm keeping busy.
Yeah, you have nothing going on. Well, whenever these new books come out or if they're re-released, we look forward to having you back on New Books Network again. Thank you again so much for talking to us today.
My pleasure. Been great fun.